Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey. Our guest on this edition of the program is Aaron David Miller, author of the recently published book, The End of Greatness: Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron Miller is currently Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and we're coming to you from Woodrow Wilson Center headquarters in downtown Washington. Prior to joining the Wilson Center, a prominent Washington-based think tank, Aaron served for 2 decades as an advisor to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state, helping formulate U.S. policy on the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli peace process. Several years ago, we had the privilege of interviewing him about a previous book entitled The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. The End of Greatness, which is Aaron Miller's 5th book, about which we'll be talking today, explores the concept of greatness in the presidency and argues that even as Americans yearn for a transformational president such as George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a president's ability to deliver in this post-war period is greatly diminishing. Among the many reasons he cites are the increasingly polarized nature of American politics, the rise of the personalized presidency, the relentless 24-hour news cycle, and the changing nature of the crises we as Americans face as a nation. In The End of Greatness, Aaron examines presidential history and helps us understand how greatness in the presidency, the only national office all Americans helped to select, was achieved, why it's gone, and how Americans can better come to appreciate the presidents we have rather than craving the ones we want. Aaron Miller urges citizens to increase their involvement in America's national interest by actively participating in politics instead of waiting for the next president to change the world. Aaron David Miller, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks again for hosting us here at the Center, and I am delighted to welcome my colleague from the White House, Aru Pandey.
Thank you for having me.
And you know, the Center is the living memorial to our 28th president, Woodrow Wilson.
Absolutely.
The only president with a PhD, and the only one buried in Washington, D.C.
A very interesting fact. Well, Aaron, I wanted to ask you how you came up with the premise that Americans are actually clamoring for a so-called great president in the tradition of George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whom you characterize as among our greatest presidents.
Here is where President Obama becomes, in some respects, the poster child for the gap between our expectations and a president's limited capacity to deliver. Obama's election was truly extraordinary in terms of the sense of anticipation. The morning after he was elected, I couldn't find a newspaper in downtown Washington. That had not occurred other than during snowstorms. I could not find a copy of the Washington Post. You had a president who promised a great many things. He inherited the most severe recession since the Great Depression, the 2 longest wars in American history. And he promised a transformation, and millions of Americans were prepared and willing to believe him. So that, in some respects, cued it. But this sense that we want great presidents, even though we're an individualistic, resilient people with, in some respects, an aversion to authority, there's always been this ambivalence. The Europeans do great. Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, Frederick the Great, Charlemagne. Mm-hmm. In a way, we don't crave greatness, at least the trappings of this sort of royalty and power, but in essence, we do. And we are looking for presidents, in my judgment, almost every electoral cycle to somehow rescue us from what has become a very dysfunctional politics and a lot of challenges and problems that we can't resolve. And it is the gap between those expectations and a president's capacity to deliver that, it seems to me, is the real problem. If our presidential addiction could be somehow satisfied, that is to say, if the supply of great presidents exceeded the demand, we'd be in pretty good shape. But I'm arguing, at least part of the argument, is that since our last undeniably great president, Franklin Roosevelt, we really have not had that kind of redeemer president.
And what are some of the major reasons why you think there is this gap between our expectations for a president in this day and age, a great president, that is, and his or her ability to actually deliver?
Well, first of all, the presidency has, in fact, become highly personalized. It's a lot easier for Americans to grasp the story of an individual with a wife, a family, and a presidential pet, and a set of personal experiences than it is to relate to a dysfunctional Congress of 535 members or a Supreme Court that issues verdicts and rulings that are incomprehensible very often, even to people who claim to understand the law. So it, in a way, is a natural sort of lightning rod and focus for our attention. It's made worse, of course, by the media. So much visibility that it guarantees vulnerability. The media has, in some respects, gotten in between us and our presidents. When Jack Kennedy addressed the nation on October 22nd during the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the networks went back to normal programming immediately after his speech. This was the greatest threat to American national security in the 60 years of Cold War, and yet there was no 10-hour buildup to the speech with a digital clock showing how many minutes until the president spoke. There were not two banks of analysts with computers, and there were not people talking over the president, which actually happens today. So the media has played a role in hyping the president, but also in, to some degree, trivializing him as well. No, it's a natural part of our system. Congress cannot lead. The Supreme Court is not a 24/7 proposition. Congress and the courts are in session only part-time. The president is the energizer bunny of the system, and it's only natural that we turn to them for guidance and for leadership, particularly during times of uncertainty and crisis.
You talk about the media, and a lot of it also talking about the partisan environment that we live in. Even if you have a president who has these leadership capabilities, reaching out, bridging that gap, we don't see that even with the current president, but you have such a partisan environment. How can someone overcome that to even be remotely great in this current environment?
Well, I think that's part of the problem, because if the president is perceived to be such a partisan figure, and it's really hard for me to imagine a genuinely popular president in such a partisan environment. Now, this is not the cruelest by any standard period within American history, nor is it the most partisan. We have red and blue states. Lincoln confronted gray and blue states. But there's a systemic partisanship now which denies the president the opportunity to actually create political space, to build coalitions, and to use government, whether it's big or small, as an effective agent for remedy. If the president cannot use the powers at his disposal to fix problems and to create the kind of majority required for transformative change, you really denied that kind of historic change. Now, the Affordable Health Care Act may well be judged over time to be that kind of consequential legislation, but it's perceived to be so partisan right now that it may well not be perceived over time as truly transformative. Most of the other pieces of legislation that resulted in major transformative change in American society, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, three civil rights bills, were passed with large bipartisan majorities. On the part, I might add, of very partisan presidents, FDR had fire. He was a Democrat, but he managed to create a frame of reference that folded his being a Democrat under the broader rubric of something that was good for the broader American national interest. LBJ did it as well. It's very hard for a president in this partisan environment to function as a partisan yet defend the American national interest, particularly when you have Congress whose ratings are now in single digits.
Aaron, I wanted to explore part of the title of your book, The End of Greatness. You say that Americans can't have and don't want another great president. So even if it's not possible, why wouldn't we want another great consequential president? Are the times we live in not as crisis-ridden or challenging as before? You know, why not?
Well, I know it's counterintuitive, but my cocktail for presidential greatness is composed of three C's. A crisis of nation-encumbering character that is hot, relentless, and inescapable. The character of a president and the capacity of he and one day she to ultimately know how to use the crisis and take care of the country's business. But crisis is the door opener. And my argument is maybe counterintuitive, but when you think about it, it makes sense. If in fact greatness in our political system, and I'm talking here undeniable greatness, three presidents, Washington in the 18th, Lincoln in the 19th, FDR in the 20th, are three undeniably great presidents. If crisis is required, as it most certainly is in our political system, to produce greatness in the presidency. Why would we want the kind of nation-encumbering, inescapable crisis that would risk the well-being of the nation in order to test the proposition that we could have another great president? The fact is, nations like individuals go through formative periods in their history. If they're lucky, they survive the true tests and challenges, the crucibles of development. We did. We survived the birth of the republic and the creation of a constitutional system that was prepared to be legitimate, Washington. We survived the greatest trauma that would beset any nation, which is civil war, which tore this country asunder and claimed, in terms of deaths and injuries, almost 1 million American lives. And we got through the worst depression. I'm talking 25% unemployment, a breakdown of the system, the threat of violence. It was the 30s, after all. And we got through World War II. These are the great tests and crucibles of a nation. We had the right leaders at the time. We're done, hopefully, with those kinds of crises. We don't want great presidents. We want good presidents, and we can discuss, in effect, what that means.
We will after the break. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Aaron David Miller, author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Press Conference USA online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Paul Azanor from Nigeria. Thanks for your feedback, Paul. And now let me turn to Aru for a question.
You talked about the partisan environment, the media. There's also we've become global. There are a lot of challenges in the world that can hinder a president's ability to be the leader. Talk about that. I mean, it's not just about the United States anymore, and it's not just about the U.S. affecting change or a president affecting change. There are a lot of challenges that are beyond his control.
It's absolutely true. And for much of our history, we were a continental republic with continental challenges, which allowed a president like Lincoln, even though he had quite a significant foreign policy, to focus on the task at hand, which was basically how to fight a civil war, how to keep his party together. So he had focus. The war at times was no more than 5 miles from the White House during the course of much of his presidency, which is an extraordinary fact when you think about it, because it tends to focus the mind. 20th century new challenges. And frankly, the last good war fought by any American president was World War II, the only war, I might add, that left this country stronger at home and with more influence abroad. Now, we've been a significant force abroad, but the reality is with our exposure and with the projection of American power and our involvement of the world has come so many contingencies, so many variables that presidents have to keep track of, which are frankly beyond their capacity to control. I mean, oil trades in a single market. Disruption in country X could produce repercussions in financial markets Y, including here at home. 9/11. And 9/11 was probably the most severe crisis we faced, and it was handled quite well at the beginning by the George W. Bush administration. But instead of offering an opportunity for inclusiveness, it became in many respects an exclusive crisis. A volunteer military, the expansion of the Patriot Act, National Security Agency, intrusion, all of these things. And in many respects, it shows how unpredictable the world is and how many contingencies there are if you're not careful. And this is an extremely important point because my definition of greatness in the presidency is quite a high bar. You weather this extraordinarily difficult, severe nation-encumbering crisis. You extract from the crisis some piece of transformative change on some aspect of how we see ourselves, how we govern ourselves, some political, social, or economic dimension that transforms the country forever. And finally, you rise above your narrow partisan circumstances and come to be appreciated in time as a true national resource. That's a very, very high bar. I'm not expecting or even asking any of our future presidents, or even the 12 since FDR, to fulfill that bar. I'm trying to create a realistic and a more sober standard for judging and evaluating our presidents and getting us to understand that the cardboard characterization that we have of our president, elected with mandate, brilliant and attractive figure, gives speech, and somehow magically, opposition fades away and transformative change occurs. We have this notion that the president is the persuader in chief, and if only he would tell the right story, if only he would create the right narrative, then people would understand. But the reality is presidents are limited by the circumstances in which they inherit. And the great ones intuited and exploited those moments. They understood what was possible. Teddy Roosevelt lamented the fact that he didn't have, even though he was quite a consequential president, he belongs in my second category of what I call the close but no cigar president, he lamented the fact that he didn't have a crisis. In fact, he said that had there been no Civil War, no one would have known Lincoln's name. Think about it. We have to understand that presidents, to a large degree, operate within the circumstances that they inherit. If those circumstances are ripe and replete with the prospects of change, smart presidents can intuit it and enlarge those opportunities. Lyndon Johnson, for example, inherited the trauma created by Kennedy's assassination. But the civil rights movement was brewing. And Johnson took advantage of the fact that the country was seething. He feared violence. And he saw this as a real opportunity to do what Kennedy had started, which was to pass a comprehensive civil rights bill. And he worked with Congress, which was functional, with R's and, of course, the D's, and produced the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was one of the most significant pieces of social legislation in the 20th century, if not the most significant. So they inherit circumstances. If they have the right ones and the character and capacity to go with it, they have a shot at getting in the Presidential Greatness Club. And the problem is, or the reality is, that since FDR, the three C's, like the sun, the moon, and the stars, have just not aligned.
So David Aaron Miller, as you said, we don't want a great president because we don't necessarily want to have the crisis that would precipitate the need for a great president. So does that mean that having a good or competent president is the new definition of great?
Well, look, it was John King from CNN who, when I interviewed him for the book, said, you ought to think about greatness with a small g, which is basically the last chapter. I'm not a declinist, and I believe that acts of greatness in the presidency are still possible. I identify three presidents since FDR that I believe had traces of greatness, real or perceived. Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Ronald Reagan. Undeniably great presidents, water walkers, none of them, none of them. Acts of greatness are still possible in the presidency, but we have to factor them in according to, in my judgment, a new standard. And the new standard is good, not in the banal sense of the word. Good in the sense that they are effective. Good in the sense that they're morally sensible and abide by the law. And finally, good in the sense that they know themselves and they have, to use the fashionable word, emotional intelligence. They're not haunted by demons and aspirations that lead them to bad places. And we've seen many presidents who could not control their demons.
Nixon
and
comes to mind.
That is critically important. One additional point. The word I is used twice in our own Constitution. When someone first asked me that question, I couldn't answer it. I had to go look it up. Why would a personal pronoun be used in the Constitution of the United States? It's because the inaugural oath is embedded in the document, and the founders intended it that way, because the source of authority is not the president, it's us. I wrote this book to start a national conversation in which all Americans have a stake. This is our office, the only one we could vote for, and it remains the most salient and dominant element in our political system. We just have to get a grip and get real about what our presidents can achieve and what our own expectations could be. We can't afford to infantilize ourselves by assuming that we should sit around and wait to be rescued by the one. I guarantee you, less than a year from now, that's exactly what we're going to be doing.
Aaron, based on your description of what we would want, a good president, effective and decisive, these are early days, but where do you think President Obama fits so far on this spectrum of greatness?
One of the most polarizing figures, and by the way, Lincoln and FDR were hated men. They were also polarizing partisans, although they were beset with circumstances and had the kind of character and capacity necessary to meet those circumstances. Look, Barack Obama is not the catastrophic incompetent that his detractors want to depict him as, but nor is he the redeemer or the savior that his adherents wanted. And in that sense, you can't ride into Washington recreating part of the train journey that Lincoln took from Springfield. You can't get sworn in on the Lincoln Bible. You can't have your inaugural lunch served on replicas of Mary Todd Lincoln's china and reproduce the exact same meal that Lincoln ate, right down to the sour cherry chutney, and use the kind of rhetoric that he used and not create a frame of reference that is so aspirational that it's impossible to meet. He was dealt a bad hand. The economy ultimately will recover. maybe within the next decade, a conclusive judgment will be reached on whether or not the Affordable Health Care Act is in fact the transformational piece of legislation that the administration believes. All of that may be true. It usually takes a generation to actually put a presidency in perspective. My only point is, you've got a president now with 40% approval rating. You have members of his own party running away from him. There is a sense of emptiness and disappointment between what was promised and what was delivered. It's not personal. I think in many respects, he offered so much in terms of the presidency. But you want to create that kind of frame of reference, you're really setting yourself up to be the disappointer in chief. And right now, it may not be true 5 years from now, but right now that's the way he's perceived.
Well, how much does that have to do with character and capacity in the sense that, you know, he was a senator, didn't have too much political experience, and then he came into office with the expectation of being a transformational leader who's going to solve the economy and end two wars, and also his personality, the fact that, you know, many criticize him for not reaching out, despite there being a partisan environment, not reaching out to the other side and really developing relationships. I mean, how much of it has to do with the president's character or personality or who they are as a person?
I think a lot. Although operating in these circumstances, it really handicaps a president. The notion somehow that you can talk your way into transformative change is just not true. You have to be hands-on. You've got to be able to engage with Congress, and maybe the Republicans really were the just say no Congress. But then the question is, why create the expectation that you're going to be a postpartisan president, when in fact being a postpartisan president was simply not possible? It's an inaccurate reading of the real estate and the landscape. And again, you set yourself up and you stress the system besides. In terms of character, I think there is an issue of whether or not he really enjoyed politics. FDR did, Clinton did, yeah. Reagan did, and you could tell. And it's an important element to have that partisanship and that fire if it can be used in a hands-on way to create relationships with the other side and to create a frame of reference. I mean, Bill Moyer said that there are only interim reports on presidents. And I think that's a very interesting point. You do need time and perspective, and time and perspective will be required to evaluate the Obama presidency. Who succeeds him will be extremely important. If it's a Republican, it may well be that some of his efforts at transformation won't succeed. If he maintains party control, then I think it'll work to his advantage. What we know now is quite clear. He is a historic president for who he is. And he, I think, validated a political system that all of us should, frankly, take a great deal of pride in. It's a remarkable system. Whether he'll be judged a great president for what he's done, more time is going to be required to sort that out.
Well, that leads me to ask you, given that there will be a lot of attention after the midterm elections on the next presidential election coming up in 2016, do you think President Obama will be assessing how whatever he does in the interim will have an impact on the likely future campaign of Hillary Clinton, assuming she does decide to run for president?
Well, I think this president is going to be looking to shore up whatever his legacy is going to be at home and abroad. Now, it may well be, and some studies reveal, that if you have divided government, that is to say one party controls the House and Senate and the other controls the White House, the chances actually for some sort of significant legislation may actually go up. Others argue that it will actually be much better for the Democrats to have a Republican-controlled Congress, particularly if the Republicans can't come up with an effective message that convinces most of the country that they really are trying, now that they hold legislative dominance, to solve some of the country's problems. No, this man will be thinking about his legacy. And I suspect that he'll be constrained at home and given the challenges abroad. And remember what he's dealing with now, the perception of chaos, the perception that the world is somehow on fire. Between ISIS and Ebola, you have to wonder. And managing the perception of chaos is, in fact, a skill which presidents have demonstrated they can actually do, Roosevelt in particular. Given the political circumstances and the current media cycle, it's virtually impossible for any president, it would seem to me, in these circumstances, to somehow demonstrate that he is ahead of the curve. It's really, really hard.
How do you think Hillary Clinton would try to differentiate herself from President Obama and his policies if indeed she decides to run?
I think her greatest challenge will be the drag of history. That is to say, only twice in the 20th century has a two-term president succeeded in maintaining party control, FDR and Ronald Reagan. It has not happened since Reagan to Bush 41. And it hasn't happened, I would argue, in part because we praise our presidents, but we abuse him. Like cell phones, computers and new cars. After 4 to 8 years, it's time for a new one. And that may well be one of her greatest challenges. That and the fact that she doesn't represent a sort of generational change. And you'd like to think, perhaps, that you're electing presidents that in some way, shape, or form offer new. She has to be very careful. In part, Americans may want off the roller coaster ride of what they perceive as the Obama presidency, so maybe they'll warm to a more traditional candidate who actually probably likes and does politics in a much better way than her predecessor, assuming she becomes president. But finding the right message and appealing to the generational change that he appealed to is extremely important for her. I think, however, she would probably make a pretty good president and may well have the capacity and perhaps even the character. The crisis, which we don't want, we don't want. So maybe she'd be a coalition builder, a less polarizing figure, another historic president, although given the challenges of the presidency, a great one, we'll have to see.
And finally, Aaron David Miller, back to your book, what would you recommend that the American public do differently henceforth, you know, since we're not going to be having another great president, so to speak, but, you know, what more can we as citizens do?
Right. Well, we can't amend the Constitution. We could, but we won't amend the Constitution to somehow make our political system more functional. Last chapters always disappoint, always, particularly when you're analyzing a complicated problem. I have three basic prescriptions. Number one, read more presidential history and understand why change happened and even the limitations of even some of our greatest presidents. Number two, don't think transformation. Think transactional. Competent presidents who remain within the law, who can be effective. And finally, while not giving up the idea of great, think more along the lines of good. We'll be a lot happier. And who knows, maybe we'll be able to handle not the nation-encumbering crises, but the slow bleeds, debt, our dysfunctional politics, our deficits, our dependence on hydrocarbons, our decaying infrastructure, the kind of slow bleeds that really are harming and hurting the fabric of this country.
The book is The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. The author, Aaron David Miller. Aaron, thank you so much. Congratulations on your book.
Pleasure. Glad I could be here.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. Joining me on the program was VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.